Log Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Sunday show here at Here Be Monsters, and this is June 10th, 2012. I'm Gwen Berry. I'm down in South Florida, and Jack Jodell from Saturday Afternoon Post is with me in Minneapolis.
Hi, everybody.
Today we have a guest who is an independent candidate running against Eric Cantor in Richmond, Virginia. Dr. Vivek Jain, a well-spoken candidate, I swiped that, who is a founding member of Occupy Richmond.
Great.
As with most of our guest candidates, Dr. Jain is not receiving much attention from the local media or the national. So it's your job, dear listener, and mine to bring Dr. Jain's voice and platform out to a greater public awareness. We are speaking truth to power about the crisis of humanity on planet Earth right now. So help us out. Repost this so it gets around. And I wanted to mention real quick off the top, gentlemen, I think you'll agree with me, the hi Oso. Oso's in the chat room, so hello, Oso.
Hi, Oso.
I wanted to mention real quickly how the wonderful job the students of Canada are doing right now. I don't know if anybody's following that, but they're out there in the streets bringing awareness up to their government about
Good.
The inequities of their position as students. And it's not just Canada, it's America, it's all across the globe. Dr. Jain, thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you both, Gwen and Jack. Thanks for having me on. Good evening.
It's already late. Our pleasure.
Can I ask you how you came to choose? I know perhaps you should first give us a small bio on yourself and how you got involved with the politics as they are in the moment.
Sure. Well, I'm 31 years old. I was born in India, but I grew up in Appalachia, right on the border of West Virginia and Virginia, in a small former coal mining town called Bluefield. And it was there in my boyhood that I really became sensitized to the social determinants of health. I mean, we typically think of health as being primarily shaped by your diet, maybe your genes, your lifestyle. But I saw, before I really began to study it in a formal way, that economics, class, being in an underserved area, you know, power differentials have as much of an impact on people's health and well-being, their quality of life, what kind of possibilities are even available to them, whether or not people are even able to consider certain types of futures for their children. So, I mean, these things were in my mind as a teenager in southwestern Virginia and really helped, I think, guide my undergraduate interest in pre-med studies as well as help me decide to go into medicine. My mom was a physician. She was an oncologist, helped take care of cancer patients in southwestern Virginia and surrounding counties in her regional medical center.
Wow.
And she was very much influential in terms of helping me to understand the larger responsibility of physicians to patients. You know, really exemplifying the medical golden rule, and that is to really advocate for patients beyond the clinic even. And so that much shaped my medical school experience. I was very outspoken against the Iraq War. I have, I think, maintained a deep interest in politics over the last decade, especially in the post-9/11 world. And concurrently with my medical interests, my medical studies, I've been very deeply interested in actively reading, you know, a critical way, foreign policy, economics, sociology, history, and you know, it just everything everything just seemed to gel last fall with Occupy happening in a global fashion, locally as well, with Occupy Richmond. And, you know, I was helping to teach social justice here at our state university at VCU. And it just seemed like all of the, you know, the urgency of all of the issues that Occupy was bringing to the surface really helped me consider that this could be something that I could do.
That's
well, we wish you every success, Dr. Jane, and that's a very noble undertaking and a very worthy cause. There's no doubt about that. We're very glad that you have come to this country and have decided to partake in such a fashion, and we certainly hope you knock off Eric Cantor and get elected to Congress. We need some common sense people in Congress, and we wish you every possibility of success along the way. And we know you're going to be influential in one way or another, even if you aren't elected. But you've lived in that same area for all these years now, or how have you come to try to represent that particular district?
Right. So I came to Richmond in 2003 for medical school, and I full degree. I finished my internship. Mm-hmm. I did some years of research and have been helping teach the social justice course at VCU. Mm-hmm. For the past several semesters, and so.
Dr. Jane, if I could ask you to elaborate, as we began before the show was coming on air, I think that your description also lends itself to explaining a bit about how our perspective or worldview right now is important to your choices of running for an office. I detected that you saw things on the side of a crisis in humanity in a more global aspect.
Yes, ma'am, absolutely. And I think Jack spoke to common sense.
Yes.
And you just mentioned crisis. I mean, one of my heroes is Thomas Paine, who published a pamphlet, Crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And also one called Common Sense, and I think being shaped by educators has also helped inform. I mean, being shaped by writers, pamphleteers, historians, important figures who are unfortunately de-emphasized in our education.
Mm-hmm.
People like Howard Zinn, Thomas Paine, Dr. King.
Mm-hmm.
People have also helped influence that perspective as much as my own biography has.
Well, you're drawing from a rich cadre of heroes for stimulation and for inspiration. So we certainly encourage that. What specifically in your district do you propose to offer a value to your possible constituents?
Right. So, you know, Mr. Cantor is in his sixth term now. Doubling of the poverty rate in the time that he has been in office.
Bad.
We have only seen increase in government spending despite his professed concern about debts and economics.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
small
there's
government.
Real perversion of priorities, unfortunately, but
right.
I cannot single Mr. Cantor out. You know, it's not personal, my running. I think this is one thing that really needs to be emphasized, is that this campaign is not about any kind of personal judgment on Mr. Cantor, but really an indictment of the two-party system and
right.
where parties have taken this country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the endless wars, the neoliberal policies, which have been embraced and adopted and realized through administration after administration, whether it's Democratic or Republican. You know, locally we face so many adversities. We have a 40% child poverty rate in Richmond, here, the state capital.
Mm-hmm.
Third world statistic. The third world has been brought here by all of these so-called experts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been facilitated by these neoliberal policies, which
mm-hmm.
which obscured and concealed, and the public only gets the finger pointing and
mm-hmm.
the drama of the two-party conflict that the media presents. And so, What I would like to do is first recognize that the public has been ignored, mm-hmm. has been dismissed and not included in the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we're talking about the disempowerment of the public, we really have to find ways of getting the public involved. And that mm-hmm. means a participatory campaign, really realizing participatory democracy. And so that mm-hmm. means not doing the campaign the way that the Democratic Party might, or the way mm-hmm. that Mr. Cantor might.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
How are you going about that specifically, Dr. Jane?
Sure. So there are so many myths about our political and economic system mm-hmm. that really, I think, prevent us from getting to where we need to go and from discarding some of these discredited ideas and policies which somehow get propped up as viable. And so the first thing is we have to, unplug from the establishment media. I mean, we kind of talked a little about independent media.
Mm-hmm.
Independent media is very important. Getting information out to public, just exposing them to some statistics like the unemployment rate or mm-hmm. or the problems in terms of needs, lack of these human needs, just exposing people to that information. Then also exposing people to alternatives or critiques of the current policies as they are. And so this gets into capitalism, this gets into militarism, imperialism, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But also from a public policy point of view, coming up with ways that identify resources, find out where the resources are being misallocated, finding out who is culpable for misallocating those resources, then mobilizing and informing the public to putting pressure on our officials to reappropriate those resources so that people's suffering, their needs are actually met.
Mm-hmm.
Are you talking about exposing the overabundant lobbying and corporate nature to politics in this country right now, Dr. Jane?
Well, that's huge. You know, that's a great first step. You know, lobbying. Why do we call it lobbying? Let's call it legalized bribery.
Yeah, very good. Very true.
So.
Well, it's become that, but at one time, lobbying was actually beneficial for a constituency. It has become opposite world now. You know.
Yeah.
Sure it has. And there are good individual lobbyists.
Yes, very true.
This is not to disparage people, but it's to say that a system has been created. There's a systemic crisis, and this is something that Richard Wolff, W-O-L-F-F, actually talks about, where
mm-hmm.
he says we have a systemic crisis which incentivizes the kind of behavior that is very pathologic, that is very detrimental to our democracy, to our republic, to our American principles, to our American way of life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, That allows for something like $300 million a month to be spent lobbying. What is that? I mean, you don't have a lobbyist. I don't have a lobbyist.
Call it missed opportunities to help people, because it's just going for the benefit solely, almost completely, for the benefit of corporations, and it actually ignores the needs of the people very badly.
And so when you ask, what is my campaign doing? So for example, I mentioned Richard Wolff. He's just published a great book a couple of years ago.
He's brilliant.
Called Capitalism Hits the Fan. It's a collection of very short 2 or 3 page essays on a whole number of topics, whether it's higher education, you know, jobs, etc. But that's really one of the fundamental texts that we're using. Another is Michael Parenti's Democracy for the Few.
Oh, that's fabulous. I've read that a long time ago. It's a great book.
It is. And you know,
it tells it like it is, big time, all throughout American history.
Yes. This kind of interpretation of history which acknowledges that, you know, it demolishes that myth of all of us being in the same boat. It says no. You know, when times are tough, we're not in the same boat. Most of the rich, the yachts, you know, cruising
mm-hmm.
by us, as we're just trying to pitch the water out of our small little boats.
Right.
As they're capsizing.
Right.
So it really just starts off and acknowledges that there is such a thing as class conflict, that
yeah,
our
government
is not this kind of, neutral representative of the public, but rather is captured by the most powerful and dominant interests in our society. And it's
right.
really a microcosm for the way the world is.
Mm-hmm.
And so
Great.
I think using these types of texts, getting people to talk about these kinds of texts and how it relates to what's going on, and getting people to make the connections and really provide a counter-narrative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we think about the economic crisis and how the media presented it, by blaming ordinary Americans for their predicament, rather than actually identifying all the fraud by the white-collar criminals,
yes.
by the collusion of our politicians, and the corruption in Washington with, corporate interests and billionaires, rather than
mm-hmm.
presenting that, right?
Mm-hmm. Very
and
good.
All media that basically did spotlight that. I mean, I understand that I saw today somewhere that Dylan Radigan is leaving MSNBC. He's one of those journalists who actually tries to shine a light on things.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great video of him blowing up. Hopefully so, I think. It's just
mm-hmm.
his passion and intensity where he's saying, what are
right.
we doing? Why are we pretending why are we pretending on air
yeah.
to ignore the elephant in the room? Why don't we call it out?
Yeah.
And his frustration just boils over, and the viewer is just left cheering him on, like, finally, someone gets
yeah.
it.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite true. I agree. I particularly miss Mr. Olbermann myself. He was
I do
the only
too.
One shining
yeah.
a light on Occupy, really.
Mm-hmm.
And since Olbermann left Current and went silent, have you noticed that there has been a blackout that's getting away with being
right.
a blackout, except on Link Television and Free Television, where Democracy Now! Is playing.
Very true. That's right.
Two other small days. There are these networks. It's about bringing, and I think, Dr. Jane, what you're saying is bringing this independent and citizen media to the as much as we can, to put it out there so that ordinary people will begin to see it and listen to it. Is
yes.
that your suggestion?
Absolutely. If we had the kind of media monopolies back in 1776, when Thomas Paine's Common Sense was about to be published,
mm-hmm.
there would have been no American Revolution.
Exactly right.
From the crown.
Very true. Yep.
And it's that kind of recognition of power and how moneyed interests want to keep people oppressed and uninformed and disempowered
right.
and disengaged and
right.
separated.
Disenfranchised, the whole ball of wax. It's very true. You know, I would, while we're on this topic, Dr. Jane, I want to encourage you to, if you haven't already done so, seek out Amy Goodman, of Democracy Now! It's not a very huge, wide audience for you, and certainly not at the local level, but every little bit helps, and she's very, very influential in progressive circles, and has had this Democracy Now! Television program and radio show for many, many, many years, and she's quite good, and I know she would be interested in talking with you, sir, and interviewing you.
She's one of my heroes, for sure.
Oh, there you go, man. Great. Yeah, I'd love to see you get on her program.
Oh, that I would love the opportunity. We'll certainly try to send another email.
Yeah, please do, and we'll do it. We'll back you up on it. We'll do the same thing.
They're doing a lot of Democracy Now! Has they have the weight of the world on their shoulders because they're one of the few televised shows that actually puts it all out there, all of what's going on, the truth out there. What is being not covered is what they cover.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but I think we still have to listen with a critical ear.
Oh, yeah.
Their coverage regarding Libya was problematic. And, I'm really glad Jack mentioned Democracy Now! Because as I think about Occupy Richmond, and our own local independent media coverage, and also the blackout by all of the corporate,
I call it muddia.
Muddia.
Because all it does is it casts obfuscation. That's all it does.
Right. As I think about that, I just have to thank people like David Martin and Contra and Silver Persinger. You know, these are local documentarians and journalists and people who are there at every single event, who edit and upload and share and just put together.
Yes, I'm aware. Yes, I've seen that work. Also, there on the greater scope, there's been people like Dennis Trainer, and then there's Lee Camp who gets his camera out there. There are a lot of people covering. You're right.
Exactly. And so what this shows, though, is that it's an opportunity for us to really develop a robust, free, independent, and open media that's able to raise the critiques that the corporate channels will not.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so we should really try to find ways of making them viable, perhaps if there is some kind of way of donating, you know, from the activist community so that artists and the news, you know, these journalists and filmmakers can have some basic living, you know, their basic needs met. That would be one kind of model, I think, that we support our own media and maybe even block out some of the...
Very true. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
See, Dr. Jane, while we're on the topic of donations, everybody knows that it costs a great deal of money to run for Congress and that sort of thing. I'm sure you wouldn't mind having a few donations come your way to help you with the printing of literature or the securing of... different funds that you may need during the campaign. Is there a website that people can go to donate to directly to your campaign?
So we've intentionally, I think, withheld on that aspect so far.
Yeah. We're
submitting the paperwork for the campaign Monday or Tuesday.
Okay.
There's a primary on Tuesday, and so
we've
really held off because we wanted to maintain our independence as much as we can, as long as we can.
Sure.
But the idea will be to solicit smaller donations from the public.
Right. You know, good.
Refusing PAC money, refusing
good.
Soft money. That's already supposed to be illegal. But
well, you want to run a thoroughly legal, thoroughly ethical, thoroughly moral campaign, and I tip my hat to you for that. That's a great, great ambition. And I just hope and pray that you will be very successful in doing so and light the way for other candidates to do the same thing.
But the websites that we've established are firecanter.com or unseatcanter.com. They all point to the same webpage.
Good, okay. Firecanter.com or unseatcanter.com. That's great. That says it all right there. That's great. Everybody go to that after the show and let's study up on it, because Eric Cantor, you know darn well he's going to be supported by every single big Wall Street bank that is out there. He's already got all kinds of cash put away for this purpose, and his Democratic opponent will probably receive a certain amount of that money himself. So it's, you know, both parties have been co-opted, and that's why I think you're running, sir. You know, the Democratic Party... in the last 35 years, it's completely changed in nature. It's gotten a lot more corporate, a lot more corporatist, and it's become less representative of labor and the common people than it used to be. And the Republican Party has been co-opted for a great many years, probably since the beginning of the last century. Since Teddy Roosevelt left office, it's done an about-face. It's really gotten bad. And it's never recovered. And it's a shame that the Democratic Party has fallen to the level that it has. And there are certain individual voices that are good, and certain independent voices like Bernie Sanders that are outstanding and very influential in their own right. But these are few and far between, and that's the tragedy of our times.
That's very true. That's very true. I'm so glad you said that, because I think... as we think about the challenges of this campaign, you know, before I was even considering a run, I looked at the Democratic candidates,
mm-hmm.
and they were both very uninspiring, unfortunately. They were both
right.
basically running on this idea of anybody but Cantor. That was
mm-hmm.
that was and remains their kind of slogan, that
mm-hmm.
I'm not Cantor, so vote for me, and
yeah.
kind of expecting the public not to really scrutinize any of their policies or positions, or really not even question the fact that they're indistinguishable from Mr. Cantor's policies.
Right.
These things that I've been trying to raise awareness about is, actually, no matter what the Beltway narrative is of Mr. Cantor being the obstructionist for Mr. Obama, the fact is Mr. Cantor and Mr. Obama actually have consensus on
mm-hmm.
most. That is, I think, a game-changing realization. And
mm-hmm.
it's very important, then, to realize why an independent campaign needs to offer an honest critique of the two-party duopoly.
With honest, objective solutions that are not tainted by corporate money or corporate influence. That's the key thing right there, I think.
Correct, and even more importantly, actually, beyond elections, is if we recognize that the public has been disempowered, then how
yeah.
do we
right.
get the public to be participating in policymaking? How do we mobilize the public? And I think Occupy, I think what we've seen in Wisconsin, they all exemplify some of the alternative ways of doing democracy.
Right. Very good point, and that's why I'm very excited about your campaign. I really am. This is very encouraging. In Eric Cantor's own district, he's getting challenged by somebody of clear mind and clear vision that isn't tainted the way he and his cronies are. It's amazing, and I'm very heartened by this, and I wish you every success in the world.
Dr. Jane, I have a direct question. I'm wondering, what if the question of unionization or unions is any part of the race, the political race that's going on in Richmond, and what you think of the unions, and actually overall, I was wondering what your opinion was of everything that has happened in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Great, great topical question, right? So
mm-hmm.
this was something I admittedly didn't know as much about prior to probably learning about social justice a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I think unions have been so long demonized and misrepresented in the way that we've learned about history,
mm-hmm.
you know, or the way that we watch news, for example. You know, we always hear news about how the Dow Jones is doing, how the markets are doing.
Mm-hmm.
But we really don't understand the predicament or insecurity that workers have been facing over the last 40 years.
Good point.
Right? The mismatch of power between workers and management.
Yep.
And if we recognize, as Richard Wolff does, this kind of systemic crisis of capitalism and the plight of workers, the numerous adversities that American workers have faced, and if we start to question some of the Wall Street narratives about what's wrong with our economic system, I think then we can begin to realize why collective bargaining, organized labor, unions are valuable, especially
mm-hmm.
coming from southwestern Virginia, you know, where there's
oh,
such
yeah.
a position of, you know, social, environmental, economic justice,
mm-hmm.
and these institutions of unions fighting back against mine owners and people who tried to exploit
mm-hmm.
People for their labor. And so, you know, what's the role of unions in Virginia? You know that Virginia is among a handful of states, which is a right-to-work state.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think because of that status, which has been on the books for years,
yeah.
Unfortunately, people don't value unions or collective bargaining or organized action.
Mm-hmm.
People, I think, have a tendency to take the side of managers, to take the side of the people who make all the profits.
It's putting the rope right around their own necks. It's very foolish, but we see it all the time. And it's a great point that you raised, Dr. Jane.
But it just goes to show how smart, you know, these managers have been since the 70s.
Yeah.
You don't need a full-on conflict. If you can propagandize or if you can get people to believe that unions are bad.
Right.
You know, propaganda is cheaper than violence.
You've already won
the battle, because then people begin with the position of being skeptical of workers and
the media has slowly but surely taken this line itself and has very subtly influenced public opinion against unions as well.
Very much so. I mean, you don't see any union representatives really being
right.
being interviewed on television, and the other aspect, of course, is the disconnectedness between, you know, the rank and the file and the union president,
bosses,
the union chiefs.
Yes, that's right.
Well, you
very
know
true.
What's troublesome in the last couple of years, from my point of view, from what I've noticed, is that I can remember how unions supported the Democratic Party and paid a lot of the bills. Mm-hmm.
And what did they get in return? You know, if we look back in 2008...
They got a kick in the ass is what
right.
they...
Yeah. They were abandoned by the Democrats. They really were.
Right.
One tweet by this president for support in Wisconsin, and a video the day of the election was all the DCCC could offer to them in support. It's really quite outrageous.
They betrayed their union membership by employing that very weak, timid effort in Wisconsin. I was so appalled by that. I still can't believe how the Democrats have basically abandoned their traditional base of working people so terribly in Wisconsin. It's unforgivable. It really is. And you know what? They've got to change their tune big time, or they've got to just be voted out of office permanently. That's terrible.
As Dr. Jane is saying, they actually, the Democratic and you know, Republican Party have become a uniform,
right?
Just uniform, and they have been doing this slowly and steadily for the last 40 years. Am
mm-hmm.
I getting you right, Dr. Jane? Is that your...
Even longer than that, you know, I read a great book in the last year called The Democrats, A Critical History. It's by a man named Lance Selfa, S-E-L-F-A. And actually, an updated edition of that book is coming out probably by the end of June, and which will include a review of President Obama's last 3 years. And so
good.
That shows that even since Harry Truman, you know, if we think about the recognition of the right to organize and all of the stuff happening in the 30s, 40s, 50s, actually the betrayal of working people has been going on for, you know, some 70 years at least. And though the Democrats enjoy this reputation in the public's consciousness of being
mm-hmm.
the party of the downtrodden,
mm-hmm.
in almost every instance they have kicked their supporters, whether it's
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Women, whether it's minorities, whether it's, you know, gays, whoever it is, they
mm-hmm.
are as corporate as the Republican Party, but
mm-hmm.
they pretend to be, and this legitimized by the media, they pretend to be the party of the downtrodden. Another great article that I read was in the New Labor Forum called The Right to Work Offensive, and it sort of talks about, going back to the original question about the role of unions and the right to work status.
Mm-hmm.
That's just another great book. And also, going back to Wisconsin, Paul Street, who's written two books on Obama and just really exposes him to be a, you know, a corporate guy, a militarist.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Really deflating this myth of him being a progressive, has written an article.
Yeah, we've seen that a long time ago, that he's not really a progressive, and we've been very disappointed.
Right. Well, I'm sorry I wasn't tuning in earlier, but I certainly will in the future. He wrote an article in the last week called Wisconsin Lessons at his blog, paulstreet.org.
And
he talks about, exactly as you're saying, this kind of half-hearted, completely insincere, self-serving, you know, move by the Democrats to really not do anything until the very end. And
it's very cynical. It's terrible, really, when you think about it. It's a betrayal.
It is.
Yeah.
And then also, even worse, to try to get people to put down their signs, stop the protesting, really dismiss the value of popular organizing and popular struggle, and instead, as Paul Street says, pick up the clipboards for electioneering.
Wonderfully said. That was brilliant. Thank you.
That's Paul Street. I mean, he's a brilliant guy. Again, his books are Barack Obama and The Future of American Politics, and then The Empire's New Clothes. He's a brilliant, brilliant activist, scholar, journalist, and he gets it. I mean, and his
website. How do we spell his last name again?
Sure. It's Street, S-T-R-E-E-T.
Just like Street. Okay, good.
Street.org.
Okay, great, great. Yeah, that's why your campaign is so exciting and invigorating for real, true progressives who do believe in social justice and economic justice, something that has appeared very seldomly in this country, especially in recent times. And we welcome any person or any group that is fostering this type of activity, because it's so badly needed in this country right now, more so than it has been in many, many, many years. We're living in a new gilded age, and it's terrible to think that the way working people and the poor have been completely abandoned over the past 40 years, especially. But it's been a non-ending struggle for these people, and they shouldn't have to engage in such a thing. It should just be automatic. But of course, we know that it will never be that way. But we need to always struggle in that direction. And a lot of people have abandoned the struggle.
There's a pall there. I see it everywhere on social media, even on Twitter. There is a pall over people. And now, you know, the diversity of tactics and the old banging of the gong for people to take up the pitchforks and hammer handles is beginning to ring in as the, you know, as the replacement. And that's very downheartening. People are frustrated. They don't know which way to turn. They put a lot of effort into Occupy. I still go to GAs over here, and we're working our groups the same way as ours is, with foreclosure actions on an individual and united basis. And also the other groups are turning towards working on the student debt, the student loans, these projects and actions, which are one of the directions that OWLS and Occupy in the web of it has been turning people to. There's a lot of trainings that go on too that are wonderful, and they're going to be putting up webinars for Occupy. I don't think people are really aware of just how much. Yes, Mike Stimson, thank you. Disheartening. Thank you. That's the word.
Yes, disheartening. Very true.
But as an occupier, I've said this several times recently, that I am by description a nonviolent resistor.
Right.
And that's from my perspective. Dr. Jane, could you tell us exactly what you think? I mean, there is the rumble in the community that we aren't pushing hard enough, perhaps. I mean, look at the absolute mess of Oakland. I mean, the Oakland occupiers, from what I can see, there's been some folks to step into the original Occupy group and sort of disenfranchise others, especially people of color. There is a very strong, thriving decolonized group going on out there with people of color and indigenous people who are very, you know, committed to the tenets of what Occupy began. There's just so much disenfranchised and disheartening because I guess it's just not enough to have, you know, the movement growing at a small pace, what people feel is a small pace. And I'm not sure whether it's just folks who are on the social networks. When I'm in the GA group, not everybody has this same kind of pull. I have to say that, too. They're hopeful people. Mm-hmm. They're working towards things. But, you know, we do a lot of our marshaling of resources online through social networks and share with one another. And while there's this pall going on, I mean, my question to you with all of this, Dr. Jane, is how do you see that and how do we alleviate that and continue positively on?
I recommend large doses of Howard Zinn. I mean, that's
that's a good answer.
Very good.
And I hate that's to give a but I think one thing is because we have been so miseducated as to how change actually happens.
Yeah.
With the kind of frustration of hopes of thinking that by casting ballots change actually happens instead of actually realizing that the achievements and protections and benefits and security that have been won through popular struggle against the great owners of wealth, the exploiters against them, that's the only mechanism of actually achieving change. None of that is taught to us in our education and history.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, all the emphasis and all the importance is placed on elections, and then inevitably people are frustrated. And then the media, whenever it's covering any kind of popular movement, tends to focus on conflict rather than, you know, conflict between protesters or disaffected people and authorities. Because
well, even between candidates, if you look at it, it's always a him versus her, him versus him thing, and it's never the issue is very rarely discussed. It's always a personality conflict. That's what they always try to do. They try and boil it down to that, and it's such a misrepresentation of what's really out there.
Yes, exactly. And so I think taking time to actually become familiar with the history mm-hmm. of different traditions and movements which have preceded us, learning from the lessons, talking with other activists, just talking and listening more. Some of these interpersonal communications have not been cultivated, not mm-hmm. in our public educational system, not in many aspects of our lives. And so when we're coming together with other people who are coming with different experiences and knowledge and you know parts of the world, it can be very cacophonous, and there can be more friction and misunderstanding than might be the case if we actually invested some time, actually mm-hmm. appreciated each other as colleagues in this common struggle together. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, this is where we need people who have experience being union organizers and other types of leaders, without assuming a leadership role. Because mm-hmm. I think we have different skills.
Consensus works. Consensus is a very good direction for us to go in because mm-hmm. All the other roads, all the other avenues, I personally don't think any of the old ologies or isms or osophies are really going to stand up to the vision we really need for the future of this mm-hmm. planet. I really mm-hmm. don't.
Right.
And then,
with some unique different challenges today.
And some of it will be invented along the way. We might find mm-hmm. that types of consensus or deliberation and decision-making that have been tried and have worked in other groups might not be right for our groups.
Mm-hmm.
And it might not be the same in a few months from now.
Mm-hmm.
But
true.
It's only month 8, right, of Occupy.
Mm-hmm.
I understand it, at least locally here in
right.
Richmond.
Yes, you're right, Dr. Jane.
So be patient as well, I think. You know, books like Paul Loeb's Soul of a Citizen, which are great introductions to kind of activism for a lot of us novices, for example, can help us kind of prepare psychologically for what interactions with other people and other activists and what the process is all about.
That's very good. Now, Dr. Jane, if I may interject for a moment, we're getting toward the end of the hour, so I wanted to make sure we covered this. We're talking, of course, nationally and globally on this program, but also we've been covering a lot of kind of macro topics, broad general topics of interest to basically everybody, but you're running for a specific seat in Congress. Would you please, just for your own candidacy's sake, give us some idea for your own particular constituents who may be listening exactly what you propose to do for your district that is not being done currently by Eric Cantor or the possible Democratic challengers? What would you do differently, for example, specifically that would benefit your district? I think this would help your candidacy to distinguish itself, too.
Sure. Well, I think jobs. You cannot emphasize the importance of the economic insecurity that people face. Again, identifying resources, identifying opportunities which have been overlooked by Mr. Cantor because he has benefited, as have the Democrats, some of the larger corporations at the expense of working people and families. Finding those opportunities, locating those resources to actually get people back to work, making sure that they're paid adequately, that there are benefits, that they enjoy the job security that every American should enjoy as a right of being American. These are issues that are very important to us and I think cannot be emphasized enough.
Right.
There are tens of thousands of people who are without jobs, who have experienced chronic long-term unemployment, who are unable to meet their daily expenses. And so Mr. Cantor talks a lot about freedom and somehow elides or omits the idea that if you're unemployed, if you don't have a job, then you cannot enjoy the right to life, liberty, or pursuit of happiness. And so
His
freedom is very rhetorical, but I think we need to provide it some reality with just recognizing and quantifying the suffering that is there in the 7th District, and then finding ways to get people employed, meeting basic human needs like lack of shelter, people who are homeless, people who have food hardship, people who have inadequate health care. These are the basic human needs that everyone must have in order to be not only free, but also to be able to participate in democracy.
Right.
As I think about some of these macro issues, and I think about how our system cultivates a kind of apathy or indifference, I'm just reminded that the purpose of education is really to prepare someone to enter democracy. And this just underscores the importance of being in touch with these issues so that people can be free, enjoy all these rights that we talk a lot about, but may not realize in our lives.
Are there specific industrial objectives for your campaign or infrastructure projects that could be undertaken in Virginia's 7th District? Or I don't know much about your district. Maybe you could educate us listeners as to what your district really needs that you will attempt to provide for them as well, specifically.
Well, you know, I think the agricultural aspect of our, you know, the agricultural opportunities are really being reconsidered for a lot of people, where you take the opportunities from the larger agribusiness, and you democratize them, and you empower people locally. So, for example, we're seeing a lot of people who are doing more of the kind of community gardening, organic gardening, these activities, which are not only consistent with environmental justice, but actually return the dollar and value back to the people who are doing all the work.
Yes, it's, and very local, healthy, too, as well.
It's local sustainability, which is very important. Permaculture is our future.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so this different model, which you know is thousands of years old, may sound, you know, new age and may sound innovative for people who are used to kind of the large scale agribusiness model of producing food,
mm-hmm.
but it's actually very sustainable. It's very democratic. It's very economically sound, and it's much more responsible. But this is certainly one of the things that we can promote, find funding for, and realize, I think.
And implement, yeah, great.
Yeah.
Good idea. Well, thank you for that. I wanted to make it specific to your district for your own benefit in your endeavor to replace Eric Cantor, and I hope it'll get some people thinking that there are other ways other than the Wall Street way, you know?
Yeah, there's so many ways that we can do it. You know, education in Virginia is in crisis.
Uh-huh.
Education not only in our town, but also in the district is also in crisis. You have under-functioning, underfunded schools. You have the adoption and implementation of federal policies, which only disempower and demoralize teachers and
mm-hmm.
leave without some of the critical thinking skills that they need in order
mm-hmm.
to be able to really contribute to our democracy and
mm-hmm.
come up with many of the solutions, challenge, you know, to tackle the challenges that we face.
Mm-hmm.
We need to do a better job of that. And so, you know, that could also provide, I think, employment. It could provide many, many benefits that we can't even foresee at this point.
Right. Well, you sound like a man of vision and a very critical thinker yourself, and that is what this country needs so badly, especially in view of the likes of Eric Cantor out there holding positions of high power and not really doing much with it for the benefit of the people. So that's something that this country severely needs, and like I mentioned before, I wish you every success in your effort. And come rain or shine or defeat or victory, whatever the case may be, we know you'll be out there plugging for your ideals and for the great ideas that you've discussed today. And we encourage you to continue to do so as long as you possibly can.
Well, we can't do it alone. You know, this is not
right.
Just a single individual. I think anyone, not only limited to the 7th District, but anyone across the state can participate. Some of the books that we've mentioned and some of the writings and authors that we've mentioned,
mm-hmm.
they can be accessed by almost anyone. And as long as there is an interest in every community and every neighborhood, we can get people to start talking to their neighbors, start talking
yeah.
to each other, discussing, making questions,
mm-hmm.
listening, engaging in debate. And that's the only way that change will ever happen.
That's
do
right, very true.
That people might reach you for your candidacy and your campaign. Do you have a telephone number?
Oh, for sure. Well, actually, we're getting a phone for the campaign, but the Facebook page is facebook.com/VIVEKJANFORVIRGINIA, Vivek Jain for Virginia. And you can actually access that through the Unseat Cantor or the FireCantor.com website.
Yeah, I've been there. It's a good page. I posted us on there today.
Yes, ma'am.
Great.
You can also reach us at Vivek for Virginia at gmail.com.
Could you repeat one more time, Dr.
Sure,
Jane?
Sure, that's vivekforvirginia@gmail.com. vivekforvirginia.com.
Great. We are at the end of the show. I do want to thank you ever so much for coming on. I would like to invite you to return and talk with us again as
yes.
you're campaigning. It would be our pleasure to have you on to talk about other issues, especially the ones that seem to pop up just over and over, new daily these days.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to encourage Amy Goodman to have you on too. I don't know how successful we'll be, but we'll certainly give it a try.
Thank you very much, both of you.
Yes, thank you very much for your refreshing candidacy and for the light and the hope that you're offering the Virginia 7th District voters.
I appreciate that, sir. Thank you very much.
You bet. Thank you, sir. Good pleasure talking with you today.
Pleasure's mine. Thank you.
Yep.
Well, gentlemen, we are at the end of the show. I want to thank the people, our folks from Roundtree and the Roundtree chat room over on Facebook for showing up and doing some excellent commentary. And our good pal Oso and Mike Stimson and Sandy White and Janelle Green was there too. I'd love to get Janelle to come on because she has some perspectives on how to get things shaken and moving that I think we should listen to and talk about.
I'm all ears.
she's a great gal. As always, I'd like everybody to realize that there are a couple of sponsors here, but primarily we are sponsored by Roundtree7, that's the number 7.com. It is a place where a lot of great writers are putting out some very progressive and innovative ideas, and that's Roundtree7.com. It is a blog with knowledge to the social consciousness. They are officially a sponsor of Here Be Monsters and also Daughters of Isis, the Ancestral Aromacology. You can find links on our show page to both of these sites. And Dr. Jane, it's been a real pleasure. We really do sincerely thank you. We do invite you in the future. And one more thing before we leave. Next week, we have Julia Trigg Crawford from Texas, who is right now under the fight for her family home against TransCanada with the tar sands pipeline. They're trying to pull an eminent domain on her ranch, and she's fighting it. She's going to be on with us. You can find her a lot in Google. If you Google Julia Trigg Crawford, there's been quite a bit of writing on the subject. She is fighting TransCanada right now out in Texas.
Wow.
So look
good.
Forward to her next week.
Very good.
And I guess that's it, guys. Thanks to the chat room and to everyone that's listening in podcast or archive. We really appreciate you coming in.
You bet. We'll see you all or hear you all next week, I hope.
That's right. We will be back for the Sunday show at 6 p.m. next week. Again, thank you, Dr. Jane, for being with us. And that's about all she wrote for today.
All right, everybody. Good night. Talk to you
next
week. Good night.